two films, one theme. This is Words and Movies.
Thank you, Alex, and welcome to yet another episode of Words and Movies. I'm your co-host, Claude Call.
And I'm your other co-host, Sean Gallagher. A few episodes back, we talked about Steve Martin when we talked about Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. In addition to being a great comic actor, and occasionally a great dramatic actor, he's also a very talented writer. He's written, among other things, screenplays such as L.A. Story and Roxanne, novels such as Shop Girl and An Object of Beauty, a memoir called Born Standing Up. And he also wrote a play a few decades ago called Picasso at the Lupina Gil, which imagined a meeting between Pablo Picasso and Albert Einstein. And Elvis Presley shows up there as well for some reason. But regardless, in addition to being a well-written play, I also enjoyed it for the fact that it asked the question, what would happen if two icons met each other? What would they talk about? And that's always been a subject that's intrigued me, and that is the subject of the two movies that we're going to be discussing on today's episode. And those movies are, from 1985, Insignificance, directed by Nicholas Roeg, and from 2020, One Night in Miami, directed by Regina King. In addition to having a common subject matter, both movies are based on plays. Both plays were adapted by the playwrights writing the screenplay, which doesn't happen too often. Both movies are period pieces, and both movies, as it happens, take place in hotel or motel rooms. And in the eternal question of whether to open up a play or not open up a play, both movies do open up their plays somewhat, and it works for both of them. Now, there is a major difference between the two in that the celebrities or icons in One Night in Miami are readily named, whereas the ones in Insignificance are not named, though you can pretty much tell who they are. And we'll talk about that when we talk about both movies. Now, before Claude tells us about Insignificance, one of the actors in Insignificance is Gary Busey. And this was actually not his first time playing a real-life figure. As a matter of fact, in one of his earliest roles, he played a real-life figure. And he even scored an Oscar nomination for Best Actor out of it. Who was the figure and the real life figure, and what was the name of the movie? I'll have that is this episode's trivia question, and I'll have the answer for that at the end of this half of the episode. But right now, Claude is going to give us the plot description for Insignificance.
Oh, I know that one. The film opens with a title card reading, "The story and its contents are entirely fictitious." It is 1954, and we're on a New York City street where a film crew is preparing to shoot a movie scene. It's a rather famous scene where the actress, and that's practically the only way she's identified, is in a white dress, and she's standing on a grate while the rush of wind caused by a huge fan to imitate the subway going by below blows her skirt up around her waist. The actress is played by Teresa Russell. The actress's husband, the ball player, played by Gary Busey, is watching with obvious discomfort while everyone gawks at her. The film cuts between this and shots of the professors, played by Michael Amiel, working on some equations in a hotel room. He's distracted by some disturbing images flashing before him. We learn later on that they're related to the bombing of Hiroshima. We're also seeing the senator. He's played by Tony Curtis. He's sitting in a bar while a baseball game plays in the background. He's ruminating how on any water we drink, statistically, was once excreted by various historical figures. After the shoot, the actress disappears into a waiting car, leaving her husband behind. She stops at a store and picks up a variety of toys, flashlights, and balloons. The senator leaves the bar and he visits the professor. He's come to alternately coax and threaten him into appearing before the House Un-American Activities Committee. The professor tries ignoring him, but that's not working. And finally, he engages in the debate, and we realize just how hard the senator is twisting information to get it to look the way he wants. The senator leaves, saying he'll be back to get him at 8 a.m. the following morning. The professor checks his pocket watch. It's showing 8:15. The actress flashes back on a memory when she was in an orphanage and she got a hold of a wristwatch. The other girls take it from her and taunt her. In the present, she impulsively asks the driver if he has a watch. He tells her it's almost 2:30, but she's not interested in the time. She just wants to borrow the watch. Suddenly, she tells him to stop the car. The actress appears at the door of the professor's hotel room, and he invites her in, although he admits he doesn't know who she is. They talk about the downside of being famous, and she says that if he'd been on 53rd Street during the shoot, she'd have been embarrassed because she knows he would look at her differently. Then she does a demonstration of the theory of relativity using the toys and the flashlights and the balloons, which he finds absolutely delightful, but also he notes that her understanding some of it isn't the same as understanding all of it. She tells the professor he's at the top of her list of people she'd like to sleep with. They decide to go to bed. Well, more accurately, she goes to bed, but he's going to go sleep in the bathtub. Meanwhile, the senator is in another room in the same hotel where he has a prostitute sent to his room. We don't see her very clearly at first, but there's definitely a resemblance to the actress, which we later learn is because she's wearing a matching wig with her outfit. Unfortunately, however, the senator turns out to be impotent. Back in the professor's room, the actress actually talks the professor into joining her in the bed, but they are interrupted by the arrival of the ball player, who has tracked her to the hotel. The ensuing discussion has us believing that the ball player is not especially smart. In fact, she literally calls him an idiot at one point. He asks if she wants a divorce, and she says no. She goes into the bathroom and begins flashing back on other bathrooms that she had been in. Meanwhile, the ball player is talking about his career with the professor, who isn't really comprehending him. Eventually, the actress faints and they go in to get her. The professor leaves them alone and goes to find another room, meeting a Cherokee elevator man played by Will Sampson, with whom he speaks. The actress and the ball player talk about their marriage. The actress tells her husband she believes she's pregnant, but he's fallen asleep by this point. The following morning, the senator arrives at the professor's room with a warrant, allowing him to confiscate all of the professor's notes, but of course, the professor is gone. Instead, he finds the actress naked and alone in the professor's bed. He mistakes her for a call girl, and while collecting the paperwork, threatens to use her to expose and embarrass the professor. Meanwhile, the senator begins having flashbacks of his own to when he was a child and likely being molested by a priest. The actress offers him a sexual favor in exchange for leaving the notes alone, but the senator, still not thinking that the actress is in fact the actress, instead punches her hard in the abdomen, causing her to collapse in pain. The professor returns while the senator is collecting the pages of the professor's work to take away with him. The professor grabs the papers and throws them out the window while the actress writhes on the bed, bleeding and in agony. The senator leaves, defeated, while the actress goes into the bathroom. As the senator leaves, the ball player returns and begins threatening him as well, but the professor convinces him to let the senator go. Through the bathroom door, the ball player suggests to her a plan he had come up with for reconciling with her. The actress, who is probably suffering a miscarriage, announces to him that their marriage is over, and he leaves. The actress pulls herself back together and returns into the hotel room where the professor confesses that he threw his work out the window. The professor reveals that he destroys his work every time he finishes it and then starts over. The actress becomes impatient with the professor, sensing that he is hiding something. He's sitting on the bed with his pocket watch, which still displaying 8:15 in one hand, and the alarm clock in the other as the hour approaches 8:15. We now learn that 8:15 was the time that the atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. He confesses to having terrible feelings of guilt about the event, and she tries to reassure him that the bomb will never be used again. Right at 8:15 a.m., as she's about to leave the hotel, he has a vision of the destruction of the room, of Hiroshima, and perhaps even the world. The actress's skirt swirls up in flames as she burns in his vision. Then the film reverses and everything in the room is restored to order as she says goodbye, and the movie freeze frames on her hand, waving to him as she leaves. Roll credits.
So, as I mentioned before, this is based on a play by Terry Johnson, and he originally wrote the play because he was inspired about hearing the fact that Marilyn Monroe, the actress, had among her possessions a signed photograph of Albert Einstein, the scientist. And originally, the play had Judy Davis playing the actress, and that's who he wanted to play the actress in the film version, because, you know, Judy Davis is still one of the great actresses who ever lived, and she's also a pretty good mimic as well. If you ever saw her, the TV productions that she did where she has played, among other people, Judy Garland and Nancy Reagan. But instead, the producer offered it to Teresa Russell, and then her husband at the time, Nicholas Rogue, came on board. And I'm going to talk about what Rogue did with the movie in a little bit, but this was not a good time in his career. You know, after co-directing Performance, which we talked about in an earlier episode, he directed a couple of the most distinctive movies of the 70s. Walkabout, which we mentioned when we talked about Rabbit Proof Fence, and then Don't Look Now, which, while I don't love, is also one of the most distinctive horror movies ever made. And then finally, The Man Who Fell to Earth, which is one of the most distinctive science fiction movies ever made, which we briefly discussed when talking about David Bowie back with Absolute Beginners and Labyrinth. But in the 80s, like a lot of directors whose career flourished in the 70s, his career started to fall by the wayside a little. First, he directed Bad Timing, the first time he made a movie with Russell, and I happen to think it's a brilliant piece of movie making, but it is not for the squeamish, and it is a rather disturbing movie. And then he made a movie called Eureka, which was taken out of his hands in the editing room. And neither of them did well at the box office, although they both have their critical defenders. And so a play adaptation might be the last thing that you'd expect from Rogue to do, given the fact that he is responsible for making some of the most visually baroque movies ever made. And cinematic versions of plays, a lot of people criticize for not being, you know, cinematic enough. But he was intrigued by the play when he saw it, although for different reasons, and I'm going to get to that in a moment. But ultimately, I think, with the example of one character, and since I haven't read the play, I can't comment on if this is the fault of the source material or the adaptation, but for the most part, I think this movie works. What about you, Claude?
Yeah, in general, it works. And it's interesting that you mentioned that, you know, common complaint about films that are based on plays, because this one, yeah, it didn't really take me out of the fact that it's a play. And so I was, you know, just constantly getting that bit and like realizing that we're kind of stuck in one place for the most part, that there isn't much that happens elsewhere, except for, like, you know, there's the elevator and the roof and the bar and, you know, and not much else. And so I had that little bit of a problem with it, but the story itself is intriguing. I think it was generally well portrayed. The reveal of the atomic bomb, you kind of got it at first and then you kind of didn't. And because there was that cut to the woman in the garden and I wasn't really sure what was happening there. And then I realized, okay, this is like somebody else who's going to be a victim of the bomb. And then it finally completely tied together with the watch being stuck at 8:15. Even though it was stuck at 8:15, he says, since he was, I think, 8 years old, he said, well, it was a child anyway. And so it turned out to be just a weird little coincidence. And so it was, I rather enjoyed this film, you know, despite the limitation that it kind of, you know, showed to me.
Well, the way that the movie does open up the play, which Rogue was ultimately responsible for, is all those flashback scenes where you get the early career of the actress, which if you know anything about Marilyn Monroe, and I'm going to talk about her more in a second, you'll recognize some of those things. Mm-hmm. And then the flashbacks of the younger Einstein and the younger senator, who of course is Joe McCarthy, and then the younger ball player, who of course is Joe DiMaggio. So all of those sequences not only are part and parcel for Rogue's editing style of fragmented storytelling, and by the way, the editor, as I think has been on a lot of, or was on a lot of Rogue movies, including Don't Look Now, was Tony Lawson. And the cinematographer of the movie was Peter Hannon. But, you know, those flashbacks are meant to kind of distract yourself from the fact that it's a play. And Lawson also edited probably the last noteworthy movie that Rogue made, his adaptation of Roald Dahl's The Witches. But anyway, those are all not just to give psychological insights into all four characters, and also help to show that this is as much a memory piece as anything else. But it is a way of opening up the play.
Yeah, and that's fair enough. Go ahead.
Okay. Now, of course, at the time this movie was made, Albert Einstein, Marilyn Monroe, Joe McCarthy, and Joe DiMaggio were four of the most well-known figures in their respective fields. DiMaggio doesn't seem to be as well-remembered today, except maybe by hardcore Yankee fans, since he spent his career playing for the New York Yankees. Most people probably will remember him now as for the way that he treated Monroe during the short time that they were married to each other.
And hawking Mr. Coffee machines.
Well, that too. But at the time of his retirement in 1951, he had won the Most Valuable Player Award for the American League three times. He made the All-Star team in each of the 13 years that he played in the major leagues. He had nine World Series rings during his time in the Yankees. At the time that he retired, he ranked fifth in career home runs and sixth in career slugging percentage. And he also had what is still the longest hitting streak in baseball, which means getting at least one hit in consecutive games. He got one hit in 56 consecutive games. Pete Rose came to that record, came close to that record once, but no one has ever surpassed it. Now, Joe McCarthy, of course, is known today for being a monstrous figure in the U.S. Senate, and an argument as to whether he or his lawyer, Roy Cohn, ultimately did more damage to the country. And I'm not just talking damage at the time in their zealous anti-communist crusade, but also over the long term. After all, Roy Cohn served as a mentor to our 45th president. But the fact that a lot of people that McCarthy went after left who might have advised us against getting involved in the Vietnam War, among other things. But for the longest time afterwards, anyone who was trying to make any sort of recommendation about what the government should be doing to help out people other than big business would be tainted with the cry of socialism. As for Marilyn Monroe and Albert Einstein, both of them are still pretty well-remembered figures today. Monroe, I think, this is anecdotal, of course, but I think she's had more books written about her and more on-screen portrayals than any actor to come out of Hollywood. And while Einstein has had to compete with a number of scientists as far as name recognition over the years, he's also been portrayed several times. And he's also still has name recognition, if not just for coming up with the scientific equation E equals MC squared, but for other parts of his scientific research, exploits, accomplishments, and his real-life viewpoints. As a matter of fact, both of them were portrayed in movies recently. Last year, Marilyn Monroe's life was told in the Netflix biopic Blonde. That was Netflix, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. While Einstein played a supporting but crucial role in Christopher Nolan's recent biopic, Oppenheimer. But neither of them have had what I would say is a definitive cinematic portrayal. So even though their personas have stayed well known throughout the decades, Monroe because of her famous, if brief, cinematic career, while Einstein for his accomplishments, then the actors playing them, and I'm going to get to the performances in a moment, do have a little room here to maneuver. Now, Michael Emil, who's the least well-known of the actors in the movie, mostly he did work with independent filmmaker Henry Jaglom, and he doesn't really try and replicate Einstein's voice at all. As far as I can tell, he just uses his natural New York accent. And they didn't really do much distinctive in his appearance other than, of course, the frizzy hair that goes up.
And the Princeton sweatshirt.
Okay, that too. But while I don't think that he's as good as the other three actors playing the main parts in the movie, I do think he is pretty good as Einstein. Certainly, he convinces you as someone who is intelligent, who's a bit eccentric, but who also is someone who, even though as a scientist, he's constantly not trying to find, not second guessing himself, but trying to make sure he has everything true and right. I think he does show that he does have pretty strong beliefs, you know, especially where the atomic bomb was concerned, which is why that watch is set to that 8:15 time all the time. But I think he does a pretty good job of playing him.
Yeah, I think he does a fairly solid job. And there are a lot of times when he isn't, you know, unfortunately, given a ton to do. He's like listening to the monologues that the other people are spouting forth. And so his responses are just limited to like, eh, or huh, or, you know, like, you know, just very short kind of things, maybe a little bit of a chuckle, that kind of thing. And you know, there's after a while, there's not a ton of mileage that you can get out of that, but he still manages to do okay, you know, especially in some of those earlier scenes when he first meets up with the actress. And, you know, and he's kind of befuddled by her because she clearly knows who he is, and she's talking to him about as though they were old friends or something. And he's just kind of, he's there for the ride a little bit, just trying to figure out where this whole thing is going. And so that when they get to the point where she starts explaining to him her understanding of the theory of relativity, of the specific theory, that you know, he's actually a little bit like delighted to see this weird demonstration that she does with the toys and the little soldier figures and the balloons and the flashlights and everything else. And, you know, he just thinks this is, you know, very cute and very quaint, and at the same time it doesn't bug him to say, yeah, but you don't understand everything, so what's the point, really?
Well, you know, I know he's more of a plot device when it comes to the other characters.
Yeah, sure.
But at the same time, you know, there is an art to listening as an actor. Mm-hmm. And also it's implied that he and the Monroe figure have a deeper understanding of life than the other two folks.
And maybe more than you would give the actress credit for having.
Right.
When you first see her on screen.
Which I'm going to get to in a moment. But I can't remember what the name of the book was that I read, which was about a philosophical interpretation of certain movies, and this was one of them. But that was the argument that Monroe and Einstein were the ones who understood life in a way that the ball player and the senator did, that DiMaggio and McCarthy did not. Mm-hmm. I mean, they both, DiMaggio and McCarthy, at least both in this movie, do have some understanding that there's more to life than what they have. You know, the ball player, DiMaggio says at one point, you know, you think I'm stupid, right? Well, let me let you in on a little secret. I'm not stupid. I just enjoy giving the appearance of being stupid. And while I don't remember what the professor says in that, or the Senator McCarthy says in that light, but he also, you know, for all of his shamelessness and all of his zeal, has an understanding of that. And that's something that the elevator attendant, who's played by Will Sampson, who you might remember from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, points out as well. And his, I think, is the one character that does not work here, because he's just a symbol.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've had the quote unquote magical Negro symbol, and this is the magical Native American symbol. And again, not having read the play, I don't know if that's a fault of the play or the movie, but it's a character I think that's, that should have been adapted out of the movie, not least of which because we understand without him being there the deeper connection between Monroe and Einstein.
Yeah, I think, you know, they just needed the professor to be out of the room for a while, and they needed to give him something to do, and they kind of stuck him here. And yeah, I agree. The elevator operator just didn't need to be there at all.
Okay. Now, getting back to Monroe, as you alluded to a little bit earlier, Marilyn Monroe had in her life more of a deeper understanding than a lot of people give her credit for. You know, her iconic performances, including the one that is shown as being filmed at the beginning of the movie, that sequence from The 7-Year Itch,
yeah,
which is not one of my favorite movies, although she does her best with the role, is of the archetypal dumb blonde. And the her best performance in that type of role, of course, was in another movie she did with Billy Wilder a few years later, Some Like It Hot. But there was more to her than you would guess from that type of image that she had. You know, according to Joseph Mankiewicz, who directed her in a movie we talked about earlier, All About Eve, she was a voracious reader. If you watch a movie, which I'm not a big fan of, though it's worth watching, Clash by Night, directed by Fritz Lang, you'll see her giving a performance that is very unlike the performances that she's known for. It's a real naturalistic performance. And for all her flirting with method acting, if she had been able to give more performances like that one, or if she had been allowed to give more performances yeah. like that one, then, you know, maybe she wouldn't have felt so trapped in her Hollywood career. I mean, we all know that psychologically she was screwed up thanks to her upbringing from the get-go, but perhaps, you know, more sympathetic, you know, if there had been more sympathetic directors, studio executives around at that time, she might have been able to give more performances like she gave in Clash by Night, or even another movie that doesn't quite work, but she's good in, John Huston's movie The Misfits.
Mm-hmm.
But she does have that very indelible personality. And while Russell would seem to be someone who exudes the same type of sexuality that Monroe does, you know, certainly if you watch Bad Timing, you get a lot of that and more. She doesn't seem at first glance to have the same effervescence that Monroe projected on screen. She's more like the troubled Monroe underneath. And as a matter of fact, Russell did not want to do this movie when she was first approached by the producer. But while she doesn't always get the voice right for Monroe, you know, sometimes it does sound mannered, you know, I do think that she gets the intelligence that's underneath and also the troubled nature of Monroe. You know, this isn't my favorite work of hers for Rogue. Again, that's Bad Timing. And she gave better performances outside of that as well. In her early movies, Straight Time and The Last Tycoon, and then also later movies like Black Widow, not the Marvel comic book character, but a literal woman serial killer, Black Widow, who marries people, rich people, and then kills them off to inherit their money. But I do think overall she does do a fine job here as Monroe.
Yeah, it's funny you should mention both, you know, Some Like It Hot and the fact that sometimes her voice sounds a little bit mannered, as you say, is because there were a couple of times when it felt to me like she was doing Some Like It Hot Monroe. You know, she was using those specific speech patterns. And I'm thinking of the scene with her and Tony Curtis, go figure, in the I guess it was the bathroom in the train where she's chopping up the ice into the cymbal. And she's talking about, you know, her bad relationships with saxophone players and getting the fuzzy end of the lollipop and blah, 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 blah. That whole speech that she does there felt a lot like some of the speeches that the actress does in this particular movie, especially early on when she is, you know, first getting acquainted with the professor. And you know, but other than that, I generally like the job that she did. And the thing is, you know, everybody is a stand-in for somebody, you know, so it doesn't have to be a film about DiMaggio and Monroe and Einstein and McCarthy. You can just have these people standing in as somebody similar to and close enough and that kind of thing. And you're like, okay, that's fine. And it's almost better that these people aren't necessarily doing, you know, straight up impressions of Monroe and McCarthy and Einstein. You know, it might actually work a little bit better that way if they're just playing like Einstein archetypes. Like, you know what I'm talking about?
No, I know what you're talking about. I mean, the, you know, certainly Tom Conti in Oppenheimer, as far as I know, didn't attempt the Einstein impersonation. And the one movie that I've seen where someone tried to do, I think, an Einstein impersonation, that was Walter Matthau in the movie IQ. Mm-hmm. And while that wasn't the reason why the movie didn't quite work for me, unfortunately, I said, because there's a lot of talented people involved in that movie.
Yeah.
That was one of the contributing factors. Now, getting back to DiMaggio, the reason why Rogue decided to make the movie after he saw the play was that he thought the play was about the fact that no one really knows anyone. And he was especially thinking about the marriage between DiMaggio and Monroe. And unfortunately, this sort of foreshadows the fact that Rogue and Russell would eventually get divorced in real life, although there's still... Russell apparently was on good terms with him before he died. But anyway... a lot of the movie is the relationship between DiMaggio and Monroe about the fact that he was too controlling of her and she wanted a child and couldn't have one, which is both true aspects of their real life marriage. And you know, Busey, although he's not as wild here as he would be in his later roles, you know, like the first Lethal Weapon movie.
Which is what, a year later?
2 years.
Two? Okay.
I think. And Under Siege, and even when playing a nominal good guy in The Firm, you know, there is still a hot streak inside him, you know, someone who is clearly jealous of any attention that his wife gets. And then also at the same time, there's that, I hesitate to say more thoughtful side, but certainly there's a little bit of self-recognition underneath there that he conveys. And certainly Busey has an athlete's physique. I mean, granted, it's someone who hasn't played in a few years, so he's a little bit flabby, but he certainly looks like he could have been a ball player, and he has the drive of an athlete. So I think his real-life energies, Busey's, were appropriately funneled through this role.
Yeah, he reeled it in nicely. And even the scenes where he was supposed to be especially angry, he kind of kept it, you know, at least more or less under control. Even when he's, like, banging on the hotel door, you know, he could have gotten crazy. He could have, like, broken the door down. He could, no, he just, you know, trying to reason with her through the door, he's just doing it at the top of his lungs. And even in the scenes like downstairs in the bar where he tears up the pictures, and, you know, he's not, as you say, he's not getting crazy about it, but it's almost scarier that way, because he's doing this kind of tightly controlled anger thing going on. And you're just wondering when it's going to unleash.
Which apparently is how DiMaggio was in real life.
Yeah.
So now, speaking of real life, of course, we know that Albert Einstein was never called in front of the House of Un-American Activities, but because of his views, he could have been.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not too much of a stretch for McCarthy to be coming to visit him. Although it's interesting that even though he is quite willing to go to any lengths to get Einstein to testify, to force himself on Monroe, although he doesn't recognize her at all, at the same time, you get something not quite the bombast of his public persona. You get something more insidious and more dangerous here.
Yeah.
With what Curtis does. You know, I mean, you do see, you know, how he's always glistening. So clearly, yeah. There's quite a bit of insecurity and sweat going on here as well. And, you know, they might have cast Curtis for the novelty value of having him play off, you know, a Monroe-type figure after he co-starred with the real one. But in point of fact, although he was known for most of his career for playing comedies, you know, obviously Some Like It Hot, but also to great effect opposite Cary Grant, who he imitated in Some Like It Hot, in Operation Petticoat, and then to less effect when he re-teamed with Jack Lemmon with The Great Race. But Curtis had a decent career as a dramatic actor as well. You know, obviously the big one was when he starred against Burt Lancaster and more than held his own with him in Sweet Smell of Success, playing the most repulsive publicist you've ever seen in movies. But also his first time with Lancaster, the circus movie Trapeze, and of course Spartacus, where he plays a supporting role, but holds his own with Kirk Douglas and Laurence Olivier. And also, you remember he played the title role in The Boston Strangler and acquitted himself well there, too. So he does do a good job showing the absolute depravity of McCarthy, but again, without overdoing it. And even though the character is a symbol like the other major characters in the movie, you do sense his humanity, which of course makes him all the more terrifying. And that's thanks to Curtis's performance.
Yeah. And likewise, all the more tragic as well. You know, it's interesting. We keep talking about the archetypes, and the thing is that this film took great pains not to identify anybody by name. Like, even when the ball players like keep buying the bubble gum and he looks at the card, and the finally when he finds the one with his card in it, it just says the ball player on the card, which I thought was kind of cute. But there is one place where the curtain was allowed to slip a little bit, and it was early in the movie when we hear somebody calling out to the actress and actually addressed her as Miss Monroe. But other than that, we don't get names on anybody.
Right. Although, again, you know, all the hints are there.
Oh, yeah.
And not just in the watch set to 8:15, but also we have that photo collage of the actress naked, which alludes to the nude shots that Monroe did before she became an actress. And that whole collage, by the way, was created by David Hockney. And then Rogue also uses, getting back to what I talked about at the beginning of this show, a painting by Pablo Picasso, A Woman and Child on the Seashore, as a way to illustrate Monroe's pain about not being able to have children. So there are all kinds of visual hints here, as well as the dialogue hints. Now, as to what this movie is trying to say, you know, obviously it's talking about celebrity as well as death and science and other matters of, well, you know, insignificance. But, you know, I think overall it does that well. Now, there's one piece of trivia that I want to add before I answer the trivia question here, but do you have anything else that you want to add, Claude?
Well, I just wanted to go a little bit different. I think what we're looking at is, you know, these are people who are all kind of in one way or another ruminating on the nature of being famous for one reason or another, you know, whether it's Monroe for being Monroe or Einstein for being a smart guy or McCarthy for being, you know, this anti-American activities politician, you know, that kind of thing. They've all got these weird little things going on that, you know, somehow turns them into like a public persona of somebody that they don't necessarily feel who they are. And I think that shows up especially well in the scene right before the senator punches the actress, where she offers him a sexual favor, because it's like, well, what the hell, you know, because you don't really want me, you want her, speaking about Marilyn. So it's like that old B-movie song, you know, who killed Norma Jean? It was Marilyn.
Well, that's what I meant when I said this was about celebrity.
Yeah.
Okay. But anyway, the one bit of trivia that I wanted to add on here, I don't know, Claude, if you're a fan of the group Big Audio Dynamite, which is the group that Mick Jones formed after he left The Clash. But they did a song called E=MC², and they used this movie for their music video for that song.
I do remember that. Yeah, there were clips from the song.
Yes. And as far as the trivia question that I asked at the beginning of this episode, who did Gary Busey play in a movie that garnered him his only Best Actor nomination Oscar nomination for Best Actor? That would be the Buddy Holly story from 1979. He played the title character in that movie. And it's not a great movie, but it's a decent one. And of course, he's not the only one in the movie who has who played a real life figure before that. As I mentioned, Curtis played the Boston Strangler, and he also did a movie called The Great Imposter, which is sort of like the movie Catch Me If You Can, in which he's playing a guy who pretended to be various professionals, a doctor, a lawyer, things like that. And that's an interesting movie, too. You should try and dig up.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. The Buddy Holly story. I remember when that film first came out. And you know how, like, New York City has, like, very specialized marquees for some of your bigger films. This thing got a lot of hype. And Busey, even though he had been acting, like, for about 10 years at that point, he was being kind of pushed forward as, like, the next new thing. Like he hadn't done anything before. You almost thought that he was a newcomer to Hollywood, which he was absolutely not. But one of the things I do remember about that film is, like, walking through Manhattan, and the artwork for the marquee was just a silhouette. It was his silhouette of Gary as Buddy Holly holding the guitar. It's just one of those weird little things that stuck with me since.
All right. So coming up in part two, we'll be talking about One Night in Miami.
That's coming up immediately in your podcast feed, so stick around.